This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
For 6 days last month, about 600,000 students had their school days turned upside down as teachers in the Los Angeles School District went on strike. That follows a number of other labor actions by teachers last year.
I think the LA strikes brought to the forefront that the teachers weren't just advocating for themselves, but also for what they see as in the interests of the schools and the students.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the teachers' labor movement in the U.S. Then we'll head to New York State, where a new program is trying to help some students with autism succeed in school, and a university is trying to evict a photography club from its darkroom. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute with some scary movies. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. After a six-day walkout last month, the Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest district in the country, reached a new labor agreement with its teachers. On top of a 6% salary increase, the Board of Education will introduce a resolution calling on the state to cap the number of charter schools and create a governor's committee on charter schools at the next board meeting. There will also be a three-year process by which class sizes will be reduced by 4 children, and the district will hire 150 full-time nurses, 41 full-time librarians, and 17 additional full-time counselors. This strike follows a number of other job actions by teachers last year in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, and other states. Here to talk about this trend is Dr. Robert Shand, an assistant professor in the School of Education at American University in Washington, D.C. I asked Dr. Shand about his interest in the teachers' labor movement.
I was a teacher. I was a member of the United Federation of Teachers in New York City, so I do have something of a personal invested interest, but also an education policy scholar who focuses on teachers as a subject of academic inquiry, but really thinking about that in real terms and in terms of an interest in what's happening in our schools and what's the effect on students, and making sure that we're able to attract and recruit and retain the best quality teachers possible. And I think part of that is some of the things that teachers are demanding in the strikes in terms of fair pay and working conditions. So I guess as a former teacher, as a researcher, as a citizen, and as someone who is concerned about our schools and our students and the sort of future of our country, so I would say I have a multifaceted interest.
Well, already this year, there was one major labor action, the one in Los Angeles. Was that different than your average teacher strike?
I mean, it was different in a couple of ways. I wouldn't say it's dramatically different. I mean, I think that there's a growing national movement. There are two major national teacher unions, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association. And then I think certainly with the internet and the rise of social media, just as with almost any other political or policy issue, the debate has largely become nationalized. I think the LA strikes were a little bit different in a few respects, partly just in terms of magnitude. The Los Angeles Unified Schools are the second largest school district in the country. You know, obviously, LA is a major city, a major media center, so that draws a lot of attention. I think a strike of that magnitude requires a certain amount of organization, and I think more so than any others, I think the LA strikes brought to the forefront that teachers weren't just advocating for themselves and for their own pay and benefits, but also for what they see as in the interest of the schools and the students. So teacher unions are a little bit different broadly than some other labor unions because as a professional union on a matter of very clear public interest, I guess this might be similar to, for instance, police unions, they not just are sort of self-advocating, but they are expressing positions on public policy matters and kind of advocating for policies that affect their sector, for policies that affect the schools and the students. And I would say, for better or worse, there's some research that suggests that teachers are very effective advocates and they bring in more resources to schools and they are very concerned about raising the prominence of public education and our investment in public education. There's some research by Carolyn Hoxby at Stanford, for instance, that also finds, though, that they divert resources not just to what's best for the students, but also, in some cases, what's best for the teachers. I think very often that goes hand in hand, but that certainly can come into conflict at times.
What I noticed from media coverage of the strike was it seemed to be, I mean, granted, there were disagreements, but it seemed to be almost civil. No one was screaming at each other. It seemed like a civil conversation between the sides, at least in the media.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we see now the major strikes last year in West Virginia and Oklahoma and other places where maybe the other side of the bargaining table was more right-leaning politically. Those strikes were arguably more contentious. And now there's also, just recently, there's been some talk of some potential backlash. There's legislation, to some extent, there are some legislators, and who knows where it will go. And I would guess a lot of this is sort of symbolic posturing on the part of legislators that none of this is really going to turn into too much. But there's some concern that there's some backlash against teachers in West Virginia in particular that may be seen as almost sort of an attempt by the legislature to punish them for striking. And I don't think we see that as much in Los Angeles. I would tend to agree that it seems like the district genuinely wanted to do whatever they could to meet the union's demands and was being as sincere as they could in saying that they simply couldn't afford to. And that both sides really, I think, ultimately what they want is for the state of California to be providing more funding for the district.
Well, you mentioned the West Virginia strike, and that's something I wanted to get to. Those strikes last year, starting with West Virginia and then going into other states, the wildcat kind of strikes, those were much less organized and did seem much more contentious.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there certainly still was a level of organization. I mean, that there was the wildcat component where the West Virginia teachers continued striking even after the union leadership felt they had reached a deal with the state leaders. Partly it's inherently less organized simply because Los Angeles is a single district, whereas West Virginia is an entire state, and most teachers' unions are organized where the basic bargaining unit is at the level of a local school district or a county, requiring coordination across an entire state. And then West Virginia itself is a predominantly rural and mountainous state. I think to some extent it's going to be inherently less organized, and it's pretty remarkable, actually. I think the extent to which teachers self-organized, and I think social media online played a major role in that as well.
Looking ahead, are teachers becoming more emboldened or mobilized? Will we see more of these strikes, either organized or disorganized?
I think so. I mean, I think they've met with some success. I don't think teachers necessarily want to strike. I mean, I think they want to go to work and do the job that they're paid to do, and they're well aware of the disruptive effects that the strikes can have on students, on schooling. The strikes are costly to the district, to the students, and to them. So I don't know that we'll necessarily see a ton more strikes. I think maybe what we'll see is other more aggressive actions, more threats of strikes, with the hope that the threat doesn't need to be followed through, but that education leaders, administrators, those who are on the other side of the negotiating table, will see that these threats are credible, that teachers have successfully struck and received increases in pay and benefits and in funding to education in return. So I think some of the successes that we've seen of the teacher labor movement in the past year will embolden them. I think some of this is also a reaction to a number of changes in light of, we're still feeling some of the lingering effects of the Great Recession, and that education funding levels adjusted for inflation have in most places not even returned to the levels they were at pre-recession. I think there was a lot of wrong-headed policies at the federal, state, and local levels, the sense of, well, we need to share the pain, and if other people are unemployed and things like that, we need to be kind of cutting the government services as well to sort of signal that we're being austere and we're sharing the pain, which is, I think, from an economic perspective, the exact opposite of what we need to be doing in terms of stimulating the economy. But I think all of these effects still linger. And so, you know, I think it's not just the successes that we see in West Virginia and Los Angeles and other places that the movement has had, but I think it's a reaction to a number of factors, including perhaps some overstepping by education reformers, and there's some pendulum swinging in the opposite direction, continued underfunding or funding that is beneath pre-recession levels at the state and local level in many, many places, and then rising healthcare and pension costs, which continue to crowd out money for teacher salaries, for smaller classes, and for other investments. And so I think also you might see more of a push for healthcare reform and concerns on both sides of the table, the rising cost of healthcare.
I will say you can find no more different places in the world than Los Angeles and West Virginia. But were there common threads in the demands for these movements?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's the obvious ones. Everyone would advocate for more pay. I think that despite the tremendous differences, I think the challenges that public education is facing is remarkably similar in places. Teachers certainly get paid a lot more in Los Angeles than in West Virginia, but in both places, it's below the median wage for other college graduate professions. And so I think the feeling that teachers are sort of underpaid at teachers' pay and benefits has not kept pace with inflation. They're asked to contribute more and more to their health care, large classes. The idea that teachers are not just advocating for their own pay and benefits and working conditions, but advocating for the education system in general. And that's a big feature we've seen in the Red for Ed movement that has come out of the West Virginia strikes. I think there are these common threads. And then also, it might be surprising, but West Virginia has among the lowest teacher salaries in the nation. That piece is not terribly surprising, given the economy of West Virginia. But California is, despite being a really wealthy state and a fairly progressive state, is not a leading state in investing in public education. Since Proposition 13 and the strong historic opposition to taxation in California, the levels of state and local investment in public education are generally below the national average in California. So that might be a somewhat surprising similarity between the two places.
Robert Shand is an assistant professor in the School of Education at American University. To come, students with autism are getting a helping hand in Western New York. That story's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. Is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Institute for Autism Research at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, is making significant progress with a program for elementary school children with high-functioning autism. From station WBFO, senior reporter Eileen Buckley met with researchers and a parent to find out how it's providing highly effective treatment for children.
She might start rocking, she might start crying, she might just start just misbehaving.
Donna Harrington of Tonawanda is explaining how autism spectrum disorder affects her 13-year-old daughter, Gabrielle. She reached out to the college's Institute for Autism Research when her daughter was in grade school, searching for help.
She was stuck in her own head and had trouble communicating, had trouble in school understanding what we take for granted, having a conversation back and forth and eye contact, and it's a disconnect and they just don't have that piece.
Harrington's daughter participated in the Institute's school-based intervention design program. It's called SchoolMax. It's for students who have social cognitive and social behavior impairments and repetitive behaviors. This program provides skills so they can learn how to communicate better with others. Dr. Christopher LaPata is co-director of the Institute. He says the clinical trials provided significant improvements for children in elementary school with autism spectrum disorder.
Our kids are somewhat unique on the autism spectrum because they're characterized by relative strengths in cognitive and language abilities. So the kids that were in this study have IQs that are above the intellectual disability range and most often within the average range, as well as language skills within the average range. And so what we try to do in the intervention is maximize and exploit those skills to have the kids learn better social communication skills.
The school-based clinical trials were conducted at 35 school districts across the region, with 103 students participating. Half the students were placed in the SchoolMax program. The other half remained in their normal school support program.
The beauty of this program, it wasn't just Canisius and the Institute coming in and saying, do this program. We actually had a three-year study where we worked with the schools to take what we know was working in our summer program. We have a comprehensive summer program that we've been studying for years.
Dr. Marcus Tomir is also co-director at the Institute.
So it wasn't just something that happened in the therapy session or in the social skill group, but the teacher, the science teacher, the math teacher, the PE teacher knew what skill we were working on so they could reinforce the child for using that skill.
All right, guys, so we're going to start and do another skills training. But first,
Inside a classroom, teachers provide five core intervention components. This includes intensive school skill groups like how to have a conversation and therapeutic activity.
Did Adam think about Owen's reaction?
The researchers learned implementing these key intervention elements into a school environment gives a child with autism a chance to practice their communication skills while in school with other students.
When they've done longitudinal research on the kids that we serve, what they generally find is these basic impairments in social understanding and social skills without intervention tend to persist into adulthood. So we have kids that have very strong cognitive and language skills, but they can't hold a job. We're not curing the kids, but those things that tend to persist over time, we're starting to build at the earliest stages.
Harrington's daughter is now in her first year of high school, using skills she learned through the SchoolMax program. Harrington says it unleashed changes in the way her daughter communicates and interacts with others.
She knows that her voice sounds flat and that it's coming across as being rude, even though she's not rude. She knows now that if she has a problem, she knows who to generally go to.
Harrington says while her daughter still struggles with aspects of autism, the impact of SchoolMax in their lives has been huge. Once, a simple trip to the grocery store was unbearable. But Harrington says now her daughter Gabrielle's behavior has changed.
She went, she pushed the cart. We had a great time. We laughed. And I kept on checking in with her. You doing okay? You doing okay? And she's like, yeah, Mom, I'm doing good. And something that in the past that would have been, and I know this sounds very silly, but something that little can be a trigger and turn out to be a very miserable experience was actually really kind of cool.
Story from Eileen Buckley from radio station WBFO in Buffalo, New York. In New York State, students at one of the University at Albany's longest-running organizations are speaking out against a potential move from the space they've occupied for over 50 years. Members of the University Photo Service Club are hoping to keep their space that includes a dark room, which the university says hasn't been used in years. The best of our knowledge is Lucas Willard reports.
Students at one of the University at Albany's longest-running organizations are speaking out against a potential move from the space they've occupied for over 50 years. As has been the case for decades, if you head up to the third floor of the University at Albany's campus center, you'll find the home of the student-run University Photo Service. Photo Service President Sabrina Flores and Club Treasurer Aaron Connerton show me around.
So this is our main studio space, obviously. We've got our backdrop set up here.
Flores points out the studio space, lined with photos taken by students over the past half century. There's all kinds of equipment, from film cameras to a digital workstation.
Just turn the corner twice here. And this is our dark room.
The photo service dark room, with all the necessary sinks and plumbing, was custom built by students. It's the only space of its kind on campus available to all students outside of one restricted to the art department. Until its last edition was published in 2014, the office also served as home base for the student-run Torch Yearbook. The yearbook documented daily life and significant campus moments for decades. Flores shows me the 1972 yearbook, a highly regarded edition published at the height of the protest movement against the Vietnam War.
Every other photo in the sequence of pages that were graduating seniors, they included a photo of a decapitated Vietnam child. And it was like a really, it was a bold move, but like it's just such a perfect example of how much freedom this yearbook has had to include.
But now Photo Service faces pressure from the university to move.
That whole office space into this room.
The potential new space is just down the hall. Flores speaks first, then Connerton.
This would be the home base for our office, all of our storage, all of our equipment, and photo shoots with such a big, you know, member count that would all happen in this room.
We actually took a photo of one of our members holding up the size of our backdrop against the wall, and it barely fits by a couple centimeters, so it would really take up the entire room.
In a letter dated January 15th, more than a week before students returned to campus from winter break, administration officials told photo service officers they would need to move by February 15th. UAlbany proposed that the photo service office would instead be used for a student food pantry and an organization that provides used clothing for students. Photo service members were shocked. Flores says they notified alumni and over the weekend launched an online campaign to save the studio.
The messages from the alum have been, like, pouring in since we posted everything online yesterday. So it's showing that, you know, a lot of people still do care.
One photo service vet is Anthony Tazzarotti, who also edited the 1980 Torch yearbook.
The news was completely unexpected, and it was rather upsetting as well, because photo service has this long, fine tradition of service to the students and the faculty, and it was a great training ground for me and for many other people who went on to make photography part of their career.
In an email, campus spokesman Jordan Carleo Evangelist said, quote, "The challenge we face, and it's a big one, is balancing the competing demands of plus or minus 300 student organizations for a finite amount of premium space in the campus center. To address this, with the opening of the new Campus Center West addition last year, we have increasingly moved to a model in which multiple student organizations share spaces. This is not only more efficient because it ensures that spaces are being used a greater percentage of the time, but also promotes more interaction and collaboration among organizations," end quote. Again, photo service treasurer Aaron Connerton.
We really create a space for people, regardless of skill level or interest or what they know about photography, to just come and learn, and we just share what we know, and just, it's all inclusive and it's unconditional, like, support for each other, and we just want to teach what we know.
For the best of our knowledge, I'm Lucas Willard.
Definition: scary movies are scary, but we know they're movies, so why do we react? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Horror movies can be quite effective at scaring us. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Michael Grabowski, associate professor of communication at Manhattan College, determines what makes them so successful.
Why do we scream out loud when we watch a horror movie? The simple answer is because it's scary, but a deeper examination reveals a more nuanced picture. Movies hijack our perceptions and emotions, systems that had evolved within a natural environment. A field called cognitive film studies not only is uncovering why movies work the way they do, but also is leading to clues about how our brains work in the real world. Our brains filter out most of our perceptions, allowing us to focus on salient information. Editors take advantage of what psychologists call change blindness to hide continuity errors and story elements in plain sight. Some audiences may see that zombie lurking in the corner, while others are paying attention to other actions in the frame and miss the monster until it attacks. Our perceptual system is multisensory, and embodied simulation mimics the emotions of characters we perceive. When we see a hero wince in pain or a weapon land a blow, we may react as if we are feeling the pain ourselves. This social connection, on an experiential level, helps bind us to others in our group, as well as to characters on the screen. Emotions function like an action potential. They prepare us for motor action to react to what we have perceived. Fear triggers a stress response in our amygdala, quickening our pulse and secreting adrenaline and cortisol to prepare the body for fight or flight. Our cognition largely suppresses motor action while watching a movie, but if our emotions are strong enough, they can override that suppression, and we scream or jump. So the next time a movie monster makes you scream, you can take comfort in knowing why and be relieved that it's only a movie.
That was Michael Grabowski of Manhattan College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. All the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.